Then if we merely answer technology by technology, we'll only tighten the screw further. And the false solutions, in the long run, will delay a more realistic remedy. Elul's interesting too, incidentally, because the man who discovered Elul was Aldous Huxley, discovered him for American readers. Back in the, I think it's the, the early 60s it was, he read Elul and he praised Elul to his friend, quote, for having really made the case that I tried to make in the Brave New World. In other words, and he said to this friend, he was jealous of Elul because Elul had given the practical evidence for the case he'd foreseen in Brave New World, plus the fact, he said, Elul had an answer to it where he didn't. You remember that Huxley's own answer to Brave New World was the island, get away to utopian community, but that fell through in the closing pages. Huxley finished his life with no answer to the technological society. And he admitted he was jealous, I'm quoting now, jealous of the author's penetration. In fact, he compared Elul with Oswald Spengler's great magnum opus, and Huxley predicted, the technological society would be one of the 20th century's most authentic classic documents of social criticism. So let's look at Elul. Before we do so, we'll have a couple of minutes break. All right, we'll continue to get into Elul's ideas now on technology. For Elul, the essence of a technological technique is not that it's mechanical, that's too obvious. Rather, it's the more subtle mentality that grew out of the mechanical. So the mechanical element of technology is merely the crude clockwork of machinery. Whereas technique, what he calls technique, is the consciousness of a mechanism applying itself to the whole of man's life and finally to man himself. Technology is a principle of looking at things made out of a process, a mentality which rises out of a machine. The mentality whereby one uses a whole ensemble of procedures, practices, and resources all combined to achieve certain ends. Eventually, the total aggregate of the best possible means in every field together will produce a technical civilization. And this will cover all of man's acts, ranging from simple ones like producing the best shaving razor to landing on the moon. Elul says, today, no human activity escapes this technical imperative. Or elsewhere he says, our civilization is first and foremost a civilization of means. And his fear is that this technology is more and more going to be applied to man in medicine, genetics, education, vocational guidance, advertising, psychology, until, quotes, man himself will become the object of technique. Now, this development is not ideological. In other words, it's not political arguments here. So it's not restricted to one side or other of the Iron Curtain. Capitalism is the bourgeoisie's conscious realization of technique. But similarly, modern Russian communism is the proletariat's conscious realization of technique. In other words, it's common to all superindustrial societies. Now, the best way to grasp his thesis is to try and understand certain features that are basic to technique as it begins to eat up society. First of all, maybe all of them together will throw some light on what he means. His book is 400 or 500 pages, difficult to squeeze it into just a few. The first feature of technique is that technology is the blood brother of rationalism. In other words, the translation into action of man's concern to master things by means of reason alone, to make conscious account of the subconscious, to make quantitative what is really qualitative, to clarify and make precise and to order the outlines of nature, to take hold of chaos and to put order back into it. So technique is the calculus of efficiency, the reduction of facts, figures, forces, even men to visible, practicable procedures. He says all of this in the tyranny of objective rationalism. This is why, incidentally, he doesn't make this point, but others do, Napoleon was the great first modern technologist. You know, Hegel, who was the great rationalist philosopher, described Napoleon as the world spirit on horseback. Why? Because he took the ideas of Hegel and Rousseau, reason, and started to apply them to France. And he just completely ordered France and made it a new society. The technology of rationalization, or rationalism here, as we'd say. The second feature of technology is the element of artificiality. Because soon techniques rapidly approached the point where the natural environment is replaced by the technological. Some scientists like Richard Lamners applaud this. He said man lives better in a concrete jungle than he does in a real one. But more of us are rather ill at ease with the plastic unnaturalness of such a world. Remember most of our reactions, perhaps most people's reactions to the fact that L.A. had the glorious first in planting plastic trees in the city there. But it all makes the point, at a certain point, technology demands the increase of artificialness all around us, so that very few of us have a real touch with nature at any point. A third feature is what he calls the automatism, his word, a bit ugly, the automatism of technique, the fact that it goes on in its own automatic steam. The holy grail of the technologist is the consuming search for the one best way, technologically. And when you've found the one best way, the process immediately is obvious, self-directing. The one best way is all you need. When you've found that, everything that can be done must be done, or else the result is poor technology. What happens? If what can be done must be done is a technological value, what happens is the human values, the moral values, the aesthetic values, are either ousted or relegated to a lower position. Then only the technical is left to fight the technical. Now, you could illustrate this with the debate over the bomb. During the national French discussion of this in the 60s, Jacques Soustelle said very bluntly, "Since the bomb is possible, it's now necessary for France." No moral elements at all. Or a more telling illustration of the same thing is the story of Robert Oppenheimer. You know that Robert Oppenheimer is widely known for his lack of zeal for the H-bomb. What is not generally known is that later on he changed his mind in favor of the superbomb because he'd been shown an improved design. Oppenheimer studied the new bomb and exclaimed, "It must be tried, it's so sweet, lovely, and beautiful." In other words, when the one best way is found, technologically, the procedure is automatic. And Elul claims, this means there is no place for an individual today unless he is a technician. To be in the possession of the lightning thrust of technique is a matter of life and death for individuals alike, and no power on earth can withstand its pressures. Automatism, self-increasing and directing. If the one best way is found, it just goes on, and human values just left strewn along the wayside. Another related feature is what he calls self-augmentation, which in English is very close to the latter, but it's separate for him. The self-directing process of the one best way slowly eats up more and more to itself, and eventually man will be eaten up. And I quote, "In the future, man will apparently be confined to the role of a recording device." Or as he says elsewhere, "As technology progresses, technique modifies whatever it touches, but is itself untouchable." One last feature he mentions is another tendency which he calls monism of technology. The idea that it subsumes everything into its great all-embracing unity. The technological system becomes the system, society rather, becomes a system which is a unified whole containing everything within it. Incidentally, if this is so, the problem of technology at a certain stage, this highly superindustrial stage, is not the question of its use or abuse, as it would be at other stages, but of its very nature. It's gone beyond the point of no return. A lot of discussion centers around this today. Also, this would explain the radical's critique, insight rather, that to attack one point is only to attack the whole, because after all, they're all parts of an interlocking whole. And it's this whole which most persistently contains all change. Elul says, "The infusion of some more or less vague sentiment of human welfare cannot alter it. Not even the moral conversion of a technician could make a difference, because at best they would cease to be good technicians." So, for example, you have the area of biological engineering. The man who's in the lead of this in the world at present is a Roman Catholic biologist called Professor White. He says he will be the first, he's already had animal brains kept alive outside the animals' bodies. And the whole point is to get to the place where you could have a human brain outside the human body for the creation of the cyborgs and so on, machine-man humanoids. He says he would be the first to get there, and he thinks he'll be there within 13 years, but as a Catholic, he will not do it. course, this means the Russians, who have no such Catholic qualms or moral complaints, will go straight through and be in the lead in this area. And Alul makes the point, even the conversion of a technician doesn't make a difference. He would only cease to be a good technician and someone else will pass him, because if a thing can be done, eventually it will be done. Elul's own illustration is the implication of this in terms of the police forces of the future. For example, if you have total, instant, available information on every man, what will this mean for the police forces? Now McLuhan, who's cheerful in his moral neutrality, predicts the possibility of what he calls womb-to-tomb surveillance. He's quite cheerful about this. But Elul sees that the notion of a technically perfect police force is bound to be in line with the notion of the required availability of instant total information. Then you'll get to the stage when such technological perfection is hardly distinguishable from the harshest fears of a police state or a totalitarian regime. We will have all the information available to us about this, that, and the other, but they will have all the information on us available to them. In other words, Elul does not agree with McLuhan's facile optimism. That is what he says. The techniques of the police have as their necessary end the transformation of the entire nation into a concentration camp. Remember in the foreword to Brave New World back in 1946, Huxley, in his customary far-sighted way, remarked, "Government by clubs and firing squads is not merely inhumane, and nobody much cares about that nowadays anyway. It is demonstrably inefficient." And this is the brilliant line. "And in an age of advanced technology, inefficiency is the sin against the Holy Ghost." This is why Elul concludes the way technology is eating up more and more of the individual's freedom. Technique cannot be otherwise than totalitarian. These are just some of the features, the outline features of his idea of technique. Perhaps the most vivid summary of them is his own picture of the technology seen as a tyrant, in which all the technique which I just mentioned, these features, is only the psychology of the tyrant, the way its mind works. What's the rest of this tyrant? Well, the state becomes the circulatory apparatus of the tyrant. The economy becomes the tyrant's digestive system. And man is just reduced to being the cellular tissue where you get the feelings on the edge of the tyrant at any particular moment. In other words, the growth of technology eating up things. Such a level of technology poses its greatest threat in the present context of a mounting series of problems and the fear of social chaos. For if we hastily apply technological solutions, this could lead to a powerful marriage between government, or the state, and technology. Elul says if you saw this, these would become the most important forces in the modern world. They would buttress and reinforce each other in their aim to produce an apparently indestructible total civilization. Incidentally, if Elul's verbal pictures, and I haven't done justice to him at all, such as his image of the tyrant, were not backed by pages and pages and pages of very clear analysis and very patient documentation, his charges would just look like radical rhetoric from the streets, and they'd be good ammunition for the radicals' cartoons. But if you read Elul, you'll see that he's marked by a high honesty in his determined refusal to reduce protest just to posturing or radical truth to rhetoric. In fact, as I was saying earlier, he's openly scornful of the image and status that some have achieved in the wake of revolutionary vogue today, and he refuses to have any part of this. For instance, in literary circles, he writes of Henry Miller like this: "It's harmless to attack a crumbling middle-class morality. True, persecutions, seizures, and lawsuits have been directed against these so-called black authors, but I would like to point to the tidy profits that such minor scandals have brought them. I am somehow unable to believe in the revolutionary value of an act which makes the cash register jingle so merrily." And his descriptions of Sartre, too, is extremely precise, almost cruel in its precision, dismissing the effects of Sartre. And he doesn't see himself in any way as any leader of this revolutionary vogue, and he's got as much damning things to say about the revolutionaries as about the system itself. Now, as we glance back over all these critiques, from Max Weber through the critics of the 50s, the non-radicals, critics of the 60s, and Jacques Ellul, two general features should become prominent. Now, both of these are constantly stressed by the new left, Just mention these as we finish this section. The first is the totality of the system. Whether this is used in an optimistic way as the seamless web, or whether it's thrown as an insult at the system as the closed sales room. This should be obvious now. This is one point we should really reckon with. The nature of industrial technological society as a totality. From everything, from war to education, all the facts of society are merely integral parts of an interlocking whole. The second feature, one that's not so obvious, and perhaps until now implied more than obvious, is the latent hypocrisy of the system. In other words, what we've seen is the erosion of the Christian basis to the Western culture, and this has removed the grounding of traditional morality. Secular humanism has not replaced this with any moral system. But despite this, the American dream, as it's commonly justified, and the British sense of tradition, etc., still seem to be self-justifying in the sense they believe there is some ground to them, but they aren't. So Alul says, if we could see it, technology has eaten the heart out of it, yet they're still being justified as in the old way. The effect is so often the justification is hypocritical. Increasingly, there's a gap between principles and practice that's difficult to conceal. And this becomes, as we've seen, the spawning ground for mystification. Paul Goodman speaks of this, what he calls the sense of hollow rightness, saying the right things but for no reason. Or he speaks elsewhere of the missed revolutions, the falling short, and the compromises. William White points out it's the American dream that's going to have to give, whatever its more elderly guardians think. People are growing restive with a mythology that's too distant from the way things actually are. Kenneth Keniston speaks of the lack of credibility in modern society, and he refers to what he terms the institutionalization of hypocrisy. In other words, whether you have outright lies or devious deceptions or sincerely held delusions, either way, the totality of the system and its intrinsic hypocrisy are common themes in a growing number of analyses of society. Slowly, incidentally, this is one more reason why we should not allow Christianity to be used as a moral justification for a post-Christian society, because these people do not believe in it. And they're just doffing their caps politely to the conventions of the past using Christianity. And as Christians, we should not allow them to do this and distinguish the left from the right and so on and be a third group always, undermining these false moral justifications, which are phony. More and more, modern society is forcing our generation to the position of non-committal doubt or open cynicism. R.D. Lang states in one of his works, "Unfortunately, we're faced by the cynical lies, multifarious deceptions, and sincerely held delusions to which we are now subjected through all the media, even the organs of scholarship and science, to a position of almost total social skepticism." Of course, for those of us who are Christians, the problem is how we can be skeptical and genuinely examine that which is phony and not be cynical. We should be skeptical in many of these issues, but not cynical. Now let's come on, though, to ask the question, is all this technophobia or is it clarity of vision? Here comes the vital question. Are these critiques on the whole accurate? Do they really describe things as they really are, or do they represent the archaic politics of nostalgia blown up into a dangerous anti-technology, which is technophobia? Alvin Toffler, for instance, dismisses these people contemptuously as latter-day Luddites and technophobes. And we must certainly look at such countercharges and take them into account. If they're wrong, the entire case for the counterculture is wrong. People like Alul and so on are also wrong. So let's look at two of these and see on which side the truth really lies. A good example of such a countercharge is Alasdair MacIntyre's, the English philosopher's, critique of Marcuse. His basic contention is that Marcuse's analysis can be dismissed as fairly crude technological determinism. He's certainly right that Marcuse's analysis is often so elevated, such a high level, that it could equally well apply to any of the advanced industrial societies. In other words, there are real differences between, say, the States and Russia, and we should not ignore these, although there are many similarities, and Marcuse fails to see them. But this does not alter Marcuse's basic thesis. And it's interesting that against this, MacIntyre's otherwise brilliant arguments have an ironic result. You see, Marcuse suggests that most men are impotent because some men, i.e. for him an elite, have control through technology. McIntyre counters this by arguing that most men seem to be impotent because of the fundamental lack of control altogether. I quote, "The most impressive political fact is the accidental character of our policies. But surely, if things are beyond all human control and man is impotent, McIntyre's answer is actually far worse than Marcuse's problem. It's bad enough to have to fight a specific elite, but in situations where human policies are not controlled because not humanly controllable, it's far more gloomy." So the argument comes full circle, and he really gives you evidence arguing against himself. Actually, this is an argument of many critics today, that modern policies are accidental and uncontrollable. Some of you may have read the very interesting book by Michael Harrington called The Accidental Century. This is his whole thesis. He says originally, history stumbled on new social systems almost by accident, so that the revolutionaries of the past consciously projected and proposed visions of the future which were far ahead of the realities they knew. Today, he said, the revolutionaries unconsciously create realities which outstrip their visions. So you have a very ironic situation. No century has been more rational, scientific, technological than our own, more thought out. And yet no century has been more accidental, because these things are running away with us as technology accelerates far beyond the pace than man can see. So you see, McIntyre's answers, far from alleviating Marcuse's problem, actually points out even more explicitly yet another area where the effect of technology serves only to tighten the screw. David Reisman had actually seen this earlier. Incidentally, Skip was telling me he's at Harvard now, not Yale. Reisman said, "Who really runs things? What people fail to see is that while it may take leadership to start things running or to stop them, very little leadership is needed once things are underway. But indeed, things can get terribly snarled up and still keep running." In other words, Marcuse's argument, and McIntyre's argument, is no answer at all. A second man who says that all this is merely technophobia is Toffler. Toffler gives us a robust and spirited defense of technology and an indignant blast of technophobia. He says this is outdated pessimism. I quote, "Kept alive by a generation of future haters and technophobes, with their ironclad consensus belatedly hurling their rusty javelins." As against this, Toffler's an optimist because of technology, and he sees two grounds for a new hope that the dehumanization which we can see will be halted. First, he says, bureaucracy, which was dehumanizing, is being replaced by what he calls adhocracy. Bureaucracy is being replaced by adhocracy. His idea is that in every area of life, because of technology, permanence is gone, and permanence is a feature of bureaucracy. Transience is coming in. Human relationships, etc., etc., but especially in relationship to jobs. This is reflected in the working world by the rise of small task forces, created for specific purposes, just ad hoc. And so this is breaking down the old permanent features of bureaucracy. I quote, "The fast-moving, information-rich, kinetic organization of the future, filled with transient cells and extremely mobile individuals, will transcend the constricting structures of Weberian bureaucracy." That's his first argument. Secondly, he argues that the first stage, uniformity, is being replaced by diversity. And this is giving rise to greater freedom rather than lesser freedom. Now he says, the first stage, the complaints against mass standardization, were genuine. But this is only stage one of technology, a simple industrialization. Stage one was where everything was clacked out the same thing by machines. Stage two, on the other hand, gives you an abundance of choice. I quote, "It's only primitive technology that imposes standardization. Automation, by contrast, frees the pattern to endless, blinding, mind-numbing diversity." So whether we wish to design our own Mustang out of 25 different kits available, or enjoy the possibility of joining a surfeit of subcults for theosophists, UFO spotters, surfers, occultists, etc., etc., he says the essence of modern technology means that we now have the option not of one-dimensional uniformity, but of multi-dimensional overchoice, What do we say about this? Certainly the evidence for his arguments are much more substantial than McIntyre's. And we'd be wrong not to recognize a new stage of technology. Nevertheless, in his reformulation of technology and where it is now, there are still two things which militate against the freedom of man. The first is the complexity of technocracy, and the second is the increasing impotence of the individual within such a society. Neither of these is altered by Toffler's arguments. For example, if you have a society of baffling complexity, the increasing diversity does not mean increasing freedom, responsibility, participation, involvement, but rather a tendency to withdraw and leave it to others. Herman Kahn is a man who's hardly guilty of radical rage, predicts that most political decisions will soon be so far beyond the average citizen that he'll leave his decisions to the elites, the experts, the committee. You get the situation, any of you have read Alexander Solzhenitsyn's novel, For the Good of the Cause. You get the situation with the party secretary, says this. You can just tell them, this is a state institute, and the whys and the wherefores of the matter are none of our business. It's beyond us, we're just private citizens, we have no involvement. In other words, Kahn foresees the situation in which the average man, because of the complexity, will lapse further into apathy and will only require from his government a charade of justification and a good standard of living. So the complexity, in other words, will bring diversity and pluralism. But the result could well become just a new smile from Marcuse's happy consciousness, beaming down on what Mills calls the cheerful robots of the future. You know, Rome was no less totalitarian for having a whole pluralistic wealth of societies, cults and clubs, religions and cliques. It just meant that the citizens were better adapted to totalitarian control without giving vent to their grievances. If you read Toffler, much of his evidence actually points in another direction than the optimism, which is his keynote. He admits, I quote, choice may become even over-choice and freedom unfreedom. Incidentally, you see, poor Toffler is an optimist, basically, though his thesis about the future shock is that the future shock is something dangerous. So his book, if you read it carefully, has this constant tension. If he's too optimistic, he denies his thesis, which is the essence of the whole book. But if he plays on his thesis too hard, the future shock, he denies his optimism. And so many places you feel this tension clearly. At another point, he even describes technology as the great growling engine of change. And you have a passage which is reminiscent of Michael Harrington. Again, I quote, many social ills are less the consequence of oppressive control than of oppressive lack of control. The horrifying truth is that so far as much technology is concerned, no one's in charge. So once again, he's come round to where Harrington and these other and Riesman have said the technology is running away from us, and this undermines what he's saying. The wheel comes full circle, and with his super contemporary evidence, Toffler strengthens rather than weakens the arguments against technology. So I'm firmly convinced that we really need to do justice to a really careful understanding of where technology is today. Now let me come on in the closing section to look at the weakness of the new left in all this. Which is, I think we can see now, its weakness is not its critique, but its alternative. All of this is of central importance to the counterculture and also to any Christian radical who wants to go on where the counterculture left off. It shows that the case against the new left is not so much that its critique of society is faulty, but that its alternative is inadequate. Now, as we examine this now closer, we'll see that the result of this is the fact that they share many of the same humanist premises which they're trying to reject. Their revolutionary alternative, in other words, was one-dimensional too. And let me show you some facets of this. First, by way of a backdrop, it should be obvious that the ideal of a successful revolution is actually in the order of a myth. Revolution really is what you make of it. The two revolutions of 1789 and 1917, the French and the Russian, are the twin pillars of this myth. The French one especially so. Because for the first time in modern history, you had a successful revolution that was social in content, carried out on the streets. Now, of course, there were certain immediate, irreversible facts of history in 1789. For example, Louis XVI lost his head. Excuse me, dehumanizing him myself. But beyond that, revolution operates on the level of the myth in the sense that it creates a legend which goes on further and gains historical and ideological momentum. In other words, you have the legend today, the myth, that revolutions are dialectically inevitable and successful, and that all revolutionaries need to be is the midwives of history. This is the legend. Historical evidence points elsewhere. History actually is very callous to any such inevitability and cynical of such success. Yet myths like this still feed the movement. Take, for instance, the anarchists. Most anarchists take 1789 as the great prototype of revolution, despite the fact that 1789 betrays every one of the anarchist principles after a certain stage of the revolution. So what they do is use blinkers. They take certain months of the revolution, exclude all the rest, and say this is the great prototype which we must follow. Revolutions are too often the graveyards of revolutionary ideals. And in fact, 20th century realists have long predicted the betrayal of idealism by modern revolutions. Spengler warned that although socialism in his day was anti-imperialistic, he said, I quote, "One day it will become arch-expansionist itself with all the vehemence of destiny." Anyone who has a firm belief in revolutions should read Camus' The Rebel. Camus' whole book, The Rebel, is a book that's just one damning critique of modern revolution. Here's a typical sentence. "The prophetic dream of Marx and the over-inspired predictions of Hegel or Nietzsche ended by conjuring up, after the city of God had been raised to the ground, either a rational or an irrational state, but one in which in every case was founded on terror." Camus' analysis is that no modern revolution has finished without increasing the power of the state. In other words, the legend of revolution still goes on, although the reality is very different. Now, this does not mean that we opt for conservatism, but rather we should examine more closely the inner contradictions which revolutionaries have betrayed in practice. Now, these inner contradictions have inevitably brought about the failure of the New Left particularly and the counterculture generally. So we'll look at them more closely. And we'll look at two areas. I just want to show you in two areas. The first will be anarchism, and the second, Marcuse, that they had inner contradictions to their premises, which meant that they could never have succeeded. Take anarchism. That's what I was referring to briefly this morning. Anarchism has two weaknesses. The first is that the basic elements of modern anarchism are totally contradictory. And anarchism has become the uneasy alliance of two incongruous sources, two sort of strange bedfellows. The initial source of modern anarchism was religious, because anarchism has grown out of the medieval revolutions, which are millenarian and apocalyptic, stressing the necessity for deep and sudden drastic change. For instance, the so-called Christian revolutions, Father Dolcino and so on, in the Middle Ages. That was the first source of modern anarchism. The second source was the Enlightenment and the rationalistic belief in the inevitability of progress of man and the fact that you could make man perfect. Now, those are both totally, absolutely contradictory. But modern anarchism is a blend of the two. And you can see it oscillates always between drastic realism, which came from the first, and utopian romanticism, which came from the second. This, incidentally, is why anarchism includes ecumenically such extraordinarily different people. You have the English anarchist Thomas Godwin, who believed wholeheartedly that man was perfect and could be made perfect, and was a very gentle man. On the other hand, you had the Russian Michael Bakunin, who had a violent temper and admitted that his whole temperament came, quote, from a passion for destruction. And you have these two elements strongly there in all anarchism. You can see the weakness even more sharply in the classical debate of the anarchists with the Marxists. And this is a very good point to bring out if you talk with either group. The debate was between Bakunin, who represent the anarchists, incidentally backed up by the Swiss watchmakers, who were the radicals of the last century, and Marx and Engels, who represented the communists. The question's issue was this. One, how does one succeed in a revolution? And two, how does one preserve the freedom after the revolution is successful? They had this great debate. And the dilemma of the debate was that both sides were half right and both sides were half wrong, and neither side had sufficient premises that would really be a total answer. Each was betrayed by a weakness of premise at the vital place. Take the first question. How does one succeed in revolution? Here, in other words, the question of gaining control, the Marxists were correct in their insistence that revolutions to be successful must be authoritarian. Here's the speech of Engels. Engels argued, "You anarchists demand the first act of social revolution will be the abolition of authority," one of the principal anarchist tenets. "Have you, gentlemen, ever seen a revolution? A revolution is certainly the most authoritarian thing there is. It is the art whereby one part of the population imposes its will on the other part by means of rifles, bayonets, and cannons. Authoritarian means, if such there be at all." In other words, he argues, to gain control without authoritarian means, no revolution would be successful. And certainly, history has confirmed this argument. Any anarchist hoped to succeed through autonomous free-form groups, as we saw this morning, is utopian and doomed to failure. But what about the second question? If you win, how do you maintain freedom? Here, the anarchists were correct. They warned that revolutionary methods inexorably imposed their character on the end result. In other words, Bakunin strongly insisted that the organization of a revolution should resemble the final goal. Otherwise, whatever you use would be stamped on whatever was there. One of the Swiss watchmakers supported him in this speech. "How can you expect an egalitarian and free society to emerge from an authoritarian organized revolution? It's impossible. The embryo of future human society must from this moment be the faithful image of our principles of liberty, federation, and it must reject from its midst any principle leading to authority and dictatorship." But you see, here the poor anarchist is left in a real dilemma. He has neither sufficient authoritarian force to seize power, nor the necessary form after he has received it to retain power. That's why the history of anarchism is a series of lessons in a lost cause. Anarchist revolutions are sometimes disastrous, sometimes quixotic, always abortive, and the anarchists are the sorry victims of their fatal inner contradictions. They have never succeeded, and they never will. Let's take a second place where you can see the inner contradictions. We're almost finished. This is in the revolutionary thinking of Herbert Marcuse, because here his own reasoning founders on its own inescapable tensions. His treatment of Hegel is a first example. It doesn't matter at this point whether his reading of Hegel is fair or not. Marcuse is correct when he says that Hegel's dialectical principle, whatever is, cannot be true, is potentially very revolutionary. You understand this? Empiricism is that which accepts the empirical, the reality you can see. So empirical accepts that which is. The dialectics, though, transcend that which is, because they transcend the empirical. So you say, whatever is cannot be true. In other words, whatever system of society, convention, form, it's got to go. Potentially, this is extremely revolutionary. When actually, in fact, Hegel was very reactionary in practice. What Marcuse has failed to see is that this same dialectical principle also has repressive tendencies. And eventually, he goes around in a full circle from his book Reason and Revolution to his critique of pure tolerance, where he ends up in supporting quite openly a naked elite. His treatment of Freud is an even closer example, and even more extraordinary. Strange that most Marxists approve of Freud. Disapprove of Freud. And if they approve at all, it's not because his theory is right, but only his therapy is right. But Marcuse is unusual. He comes to Freud, and Freud's openly a pessimistic, openly deterministic, and openly a political conformist and conservative. Marcuse comes to Freud and tries to get an optimistic view of man out of it. He tries to use Freud to justify revolution. The task is too great. He begins by using Freud to show that all society is repressive, and he virtually locks himself in the box of repression and sort of dares people to see how he gets out. He's like a sort of Hegelian Houdini, you know, who puts himself in the box and says, Freud says this, and he goes right the way down the line and showing there's no hope, bleak despair, and then tries to demonstrate his escape. He expounds Freud admirably, in fact, with an almost perverse masochistic honesty. But I'm afraid he has no rational argument for getting out of the box. And the only escape he does achieve is just rare passages of lyrical, almost poetic quality, where he escapes his normally turgid prose. But his book is very romantic and very beautiful, but no rational answer. And 11 years later, when he wrote his next book, One Dimensional Man, he was forced to admit in the preface of that book that the previous one, Eros and Civilization, quote, this was an optimistic, euphemistic, even a positive thought. But by 1964, he'd had to give way to the bleak realism of One-Dimensional Man. And this was described by a friend of his as the dialectics of despair, and by one reviewer as one-dimensional pessimism. He was just caught. He hoped for the new man, but he could just run away into poetry when he hoped for it. When he came down to the sociological evidence, all he could face is pessimism. And if you read Marcuse, he constantly oscillates backwards and forwards between optimism and pessimism. But wherever his arguments are strongest, empirically, i.e. he gives you evidence, such as One-Dimensional Man, the overtones of his work are markedly pessimistic. Whereas wherever his arguments are weak empirically, no evidence, as in Eros and Civilization or the Essay on Liberation, his optimism is unbounded and he just soars into the skies as he sees the new man. But he can never get out of this vice. Does he choose the facts? Then he's the pessimist. Does he choose to hope? Then he finds himself running short of evidence. Marcuse has recently admitted the transformation of society is still necessary, but the agency for change is conspicuously absent. As he admits in a recent article, he is caught in a vicious circle, and all he sees to show for what he's called for is the new left effort which is falling apart, which Lenin would have described as infantile disorder. In one place, he's more honest. Despite himself and his goals, he ends actually back nearer to Freud's realistic sobriety. And this quote's interesting. Marcuse says, from the slave revolts in the ancient world to the socialist revolution, the struggle of the oppressed has always ended in a new, better system of domination. An element of self-defeat seems to be involved in this dynamic. In this sense, every revolution has also been a betrayed revolution. You can see it in Marcuse's own writings. The great refusal he calls for becomes the grand betrayal. And if people outside of Marcuse, who haven't even got the intellectual stand he had, if he can't do it, their chances of doing it are pretty slender. You could also show the same thing, incidentally, in his whole argument with Norman O'Brown. I won't go into that. But you know, the whole argument is that Norman O'Brown says that revolution should be internal, mystical, in the mind. Marcuse comes back and says, this is rubbish. Unless you have a revolution on the streets, it'll tail off into mere words. So you see, both the anarchists and the people who follow Marcuse are caught in their own one-dimensional thought systems. Their premises are either the same or similar to the vitiated premises they're seeking to root out. And they lack, because of this, any clear agency to bring about change. So they oscillate between the logic of Marxism, which achieves too much, and the logic of mysticism, which achieves nothing. This is what I said this morning. You could think about this. It takes a Marxist to make a revolution. It also takes a Marxist to appreciate the revolution he's made. The first sentence is a tribute to his clear thinking. The second sentence is a tragedy because of his inner contradictions. Now let me finish just with a postscript on making three points on all this. In conclusion, certain lessons stand out. The first is the necessary understanding of the tragedy in all this. And I really underline the word tragedy. However we arrive at the present position, one byproduct of modern technology is a mounting mood of alienation, depersonalization, and dehumanization. Whether it comes through technological evolution, as McLuhan suggests, or through totalitarian control or conditioning, or just through the disruption caused by those in revolution against such a system who bring down further oppression, the alienation for most people is only being compounded more and more as we go on. I really appreciate there's a tragedy in this, and more men from various sides are feeling this. The second lesson is the irony in all this. Describing the media, Marshall McLuhan quotes the psalmist, I think it's Psalm 115, who speaks of the idol worshippers and their idols and remarks, "Their makers grow to be like them, and so do all who trust them." Very, very interesting comparison with modern technology. Think of that. In other words, the pagan in the psalmist times had his own view of the ultimate reality of the world. So what he did was to express and extend his presuppositions of reality into the external world by creating an idol which he could worship. In other words, these were his extensions. But these in turn became his environmental presuppositions till they conditioned him to be less than he really was. And finally they stifled his human aspirations until, like his idols, he too was deaf, dumb, and immobile. He made his idols of stone and he became like them. And it's this way also, in a certain way, with the media and man. His technology is the logic of his rationalistic reductionism without the compensating basis for his aspirations in humanists. So technology changes from being the wonder of creativity to being the extension of his own presuppositions to finally being the conditioner of his environment and eventually of his nature. So you see, in the technological society, the irony is not so much that we're suffering a crisis of humanism as that we're suffering a crisis of man. Ginsburg's picture of the modern Moloch of society eating up men is merely the consequences of modern man's settled choice. Perhaps soon, like the primitive animist, modern man will endow his idols with spirits and begin to worship them. And the signs that this sort of thing is happening, more and more people are getting mystical as they speak about computers and so on. The third lesson, the last one, is the patent absurdity of searching for answers where there are none. Underline the word absurdity. The Munich comedian Karl Valentine was a rare humorist and a metaphysical clown. And he was very famous for a skit which illustrates the folly of many of the contemporary revolutionaries. In this skit, Valentine came onto the stage in almost total darkness, with just one solitary circle of light provided by a street lamp. And he paced around and around in the circle of light with a long, worried face, searching for something. And soon a policeman crossed the stage too and asked him what he'd lost, and Valentine answered he'd lost the key to his house. So the policeman joined in the hunt, down they got on their knees, and round they went in the circle of light underneath the lampstand, and after a while they just gave up, the search appeared fruitless. The policeman turns to Valentine and says, "Are you sure you lost it here?" "Oh no," says Valentine, pointing over to the dark corner, "I lost it over there." "But why on earth are you looking here?" said the policeman. "But there's no light over there," he said. A very clever metaphysical skit. If you really understand where modern man is, contemporary man with his self-drawn picture of society as the closed room with no exit, really is caught metaphysically and sociologically. And in the darkness of this room, evidently without windows, perhaps without doors, he gropes round and round the edges. As a Christian, one can only say, can one hope that somebody will dare to wonder whether there is any light other than the feeble sparks of their own making? Or are they going to stubbornly persist in treading the barren circle of such poor premises? One-dimensional man. The radicals have really got a point. They've seen much of that which is wrong, but they have no answer to it only because their own premises are themselves one-dimensional, sharing the premises of humanism, and as such they will never provide enough.